Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we're going to bring the best, brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's get together. Let's do it together. Get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Dr. Sreeni Pillai with us, MD. He's the author of Your Brain and Business, The Neurosciences of Great Leaders. He's a renowned psychiatrist, certified master, executive coach, and the author of Your Brain and Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. As a teacher, trainer, and executive coach, he's worked with a variety of partners and clients, including Mobius Executive Leadership, the Forum Corporation, the World Bank, and the list goes on. And let's say, Sreeni, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, we get into brain sciences today, neurosciences. We've heard so much about it, and it seems to be becoming an integral part of our lives, whether it's business, whether it's social, whatever the case may be. It seems as though we're beginning to learn that our brain has a tremendous effect on the outcome of almost everything we do 24 hours a day.
It really does. You know, and I think initially people thought of it as an academic discipline, but the reality is that people are often making decisions because of things that are going on in their brains. And I think because we realize that some of our decisions are conscious and others are not, trying to understand how the brain works can really make a big difference.
So the average person in business, obviously, there are disappointments every day, there are shocks every day, there's that nervousness, the anticipation of the decision that's going to be made. And with each one of these experiences, the brain also is working. Is the brain protecting us? Is the brain moving us forward, holding us back? How do we start to control all of the mechanisms of that brain that's in there that really causes what we do and how we are?
Well, you know, there are a number of different ways in which we can do this. I think you make an absolutely accurate point, which is that our everyday anxieties, our causes for concern all register in the brain. And the fear center of the brain is called the amygdala. And when people are afraid, they can either be consciously afraid or they can be unconsciously afraid, meaning you may actually be having anxiety going on in your brain without knowing it. And so what we know from our experiments in science is that when conscious fear affects the brain, it activates the amygdala or the fear center of the brain. And when unconscious fear activates the brain, it still activates the amygdala, meaning if you ask people, what have you seen, when we show them a frightening picture or threatening picture, they say that they've seen nothing. But when we look in the brain, we actually see that the amygdala is activating. And this part of the brain is so sensitive to fear that even in people who have a certain kind of blindness known as cortical blindness, for all intents and purposes they cannot see, if we present a fearful or threatening picture to them, the amygdala will still activate, indicating that the fear center of the brain really does activate to fear, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And in decision making in businesses, this is actually particularly important because the fear center of the brain connects to the thinking center of the brain. And when you get ripples going through the fear center of the brain, they actually spread to the thinking center of the brain and can disrupt this. Now, this usually works in a U-shaped curve in the sense that initially, the anxiety can actually be organizing. It can help you focus. It can help you concentrate. But at a particular point, you start to have diminishing returns. And what we need to do when we're thinking about brain science in business is to target those parts of the brain that can help us reduce anxiety. And what we do in order to do this is to target the frontal lobe where this thinking occurs that is connected to the anxiety center, and we can also target the actual anxiety center itself. And if you'd like me to go into some of the methods with which we target the frontal lobe, I'd be happy to do that.
No, absolutely. I would love to hear it. Go ahead.
So yes. There are a number of different methods that we use to target the frontal lobe. One of the most powerful methods is reframing. You know, you take a particular situation and you look at it another way. Now, a lot of people might say, well, you know, what difference does that make? You're still looking at the same situation. But what they don't recognize is that when you reframe a situation effectively, it actually changes your brain activation in the frontal lobe, and it changes the activation in the amygdala and can improve thinking with regard to decision making. So if you take a simple decision like, you know, if a person's in a business and a person's feeling like they've gone through a series of negative occurrences, they've lost money through the last few sales, they're trying to figure out how to recover, there may be some people who are focusing on the losses, whereas other people reframe this and say, I've had these losses, but how do I focus on solutions? And that simple reframing can actually change the activation in the brain. The mnemonic I often use to help people think about this is a mnemonic I call Safe Frame, which is essentially resolving existing conflicts so that you can understand what's going on, reassessing the situation, refocusing, reengaging, and reframing. And essentially, all of those ways are ways of changing the activation in the frontal lobe. But there's also a relatively simple way of accessing the amygdala or the fear center of the brain in high-stress situations. And here what one can do is, rather than overanalyze, because, you know, a lot of times in stressful situations, people are always analyzing and asking why and how did this happen and how do I deal with this. That is helpful up to a particular point. But if you're looking for an effective timeout, if you're looking for a way in which you can reach that fear center directly and decrease its activation, you can do what we call emotional introspection, which is really just a big word for saying mindfulness. And what this means is that we can place our attention on where we feel the anxiety, whether we feel it in our chests or our stomachs. You simply place your attention there without any kind of judgment or analysis. And if you're not feeling the anxiety in a particular part of your body, you can actually just place your attention on your breath. And doing this just for a few minutes will change the activation in your amygdala. In fact, studies have shown that the fear center of the brain will actually decrease its activation if you simply do this without asking any questions or having any judgment.
Okay, Srini, let's take this a little step farther and let's make it a little more simple. So the difference between focus on the loss or focus on the gain, if I focus on the gain, I'm going to release endorphins. I'm going to release certain chemicals. If I focus on the loss, I'm going to release certain chemicals. Based on the chemicals I released from that thought, that picture, that whatever creates the image releases the chemical, it's the activating factor, will cause me to think and feel. So if when you're saying when you refocus, what it does, it sends out a different chemical for a different reaction. If I'm upset, if I'm depressed and I decide to smile. If I smile, I'm going to release endorphins. Endorphins in turn will make me feel good. It'll calm me down. So in essence, if we understand this based on what's going on, if we do the right action will open up the pathway to the brain to get the result we want.
That's a great way of reframing what I just said.
Yeah. Okay, so in essence, that's really what we're dealing with is if we understand ourselves and understand the dynamic of the brain and what occurs, my goodness, you could control everything that's going on. You wouldn't have to go through the panic and the pressure.
Absolutely. So the brain that is constantly looking out for danger and that is seeking out threat to try to see what is wrong, that particular brain has all of its attention dedicated to negative things. So if you have 10 units of attention, for example, if 7 of those units are taken up looking for negative things, you only have 3 units left for problem solving. So a lot of people are unfair to themselves when they allow their minds to simply be focused on the negative things. If you release your attention from some of those things, and again, this is not an overnight thing, it's something that often requires a lot of practice. Once you learn how to practice this, you can learn how to refocus your attention on what is positive and thereby find more solution.
Okay, so if I'm, you said it earlier, I'm just going to repeat it. Just so if I'm in a business situation and I feel myself extremely stressed, if I could just walk away for a few minutes, quote unquote, take the time out, take a couple of deep breaths, get myself mindful, center myself, and allow my own, the mechanics of my own body to come into play to be able to get me what I want. It's just that simple. The dynamic that occurs is not that simple, but just the process to get there is.
Exactly, because what you have to remind yourself at that point is to change your focus from focusing on the problems to focusing on the solution.
Yeah. Okay, which in essence, that sets up a completely different chain of events.
That's correct.
Oh, okay. And now where did you become aware of this? Where was it? And I know that neurosciences in the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years is really starting to take advances. Most people, most professionals are starting to realize that there's something beyond a smile or beyond a frown and what occurs and causes you to do and be what you are. But where was it that, that scientists, that, that's provable part of our world, has started to take a look at this, and the medical profession is looking at it and saying, there's more to what people come in to us to see than meets the eye here?
Well, there are a lot of different contexts in which scientists look at this. They look at it all the way from laboratory studies in animals to the actual lab. In terms of my own life, I had studied brain imaging research for the past 17 years. And so what I did was I worked in a brain imaging laboratory at McLean Hospital, which is Harvard's largest psychiatric hospital. And what we did was essentially ask people to lie in brain imaging scanners while we offered them different stimuli to see how this would change what was going on in their brains. And by looking at what was going on in their brains, we were able to tell what fear would do to the brain or what changing their attention would do to the brain. And this was, this kind of research is not just done at Harvard. It's done in a lot of different centers throughout the country in labs. And the methodology is called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And what that is that we observe changes in brain blood flow when we expose a person to different stimuli.
Now, we have known about the fight-or-flight mechanism for years and years and years and years and years. I don't really realize, I don't really think that people have put practical application to the end result of what we're dealing with here. Because the, you know, that primitive area of mind, if you're in a relationship and somebody looks at you in a certain way, and that image goes to the brain and it's going to move back to a recognizable experience that you had in the past, causing that emotion for today. And I think it's all the same thing. Today, we're really starting to take a look at it and measuring it as it happens and saying, okay, this is the dynamic that occurs. I use that word 1,000 times. This is the dynamic that occurs when you're faced with something. But we are always protecting ourselves. If we don't understand it, if it's not familiar to us, if we don't feel confident within the circumstance that we're in, it's that protection mechanism that comes up. And most people give examples of exaggerated. It happens every day to almost everybody on this planet in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. You know, it's really so interesting to understand. I think for me, the beauty of this whole field is that we're now at a point where we can begin to apply some of this knowledge. And even how we talk to ourselves at times of stress is actually pretty important. You know, there was a recent study that was done that showed that when you give yourself self-instructions like do not drop the wine on the white couch, or sure, do not do this thing, or do not do this forbidden thing, the brain under stress is much more likely to do the exact opposite of what you're telling it. And I think that's another example of how neuroscience and psychological research has helped us understand in that particular instance that when you're framing an instruction to yourself under stress, frame it in the positive rather than the negative. Because when you frame it in the negative, under stress, the conscious brain is not able to actually interpret that. And what ends up happening is you end up doing the exact opposite of what you want.
Well, also, it comes unconscious. And you said that early on. Was it Damasio around 1992, 94 something, who created the hypothesis of the somatic marker? And it's that somatic marker that's going to cause something, and it's such an unconscious activation of a memory that you're not even thinking about it. That's that emotional trigger, that tag, that causes a reaction within you, And most of us don't put it together with what's going on at the time, and the emotions that we're having don't make sense. But it could have been something that happened in the past, that it was an unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience. Triggers everything that you're talking about. And it's having the control of that in and of itself. What a difference that would make in a person's life when they begin to realize what's occurring and why they're experiencing what they're experiencing, and with a simple breath and get mindful, get yourself centered, you can change the entire circumstance.
Absolutely. You know, the somatic marker hypothesis is really a very powerful hypothesis because it helps us understand that when you have an event that occurs that stimulates an old memory, part of the reason that happens is because that event gets registered in your brain as an electrical current, and that current will often travel to stimulate some kind of matching event that occurred in the past. And so the somatic marker hypothesis helped us understand, as you pointed out, that there are a lot of unconscious phenomena that can actually change the way in which we react to circumstances, and what's happening may not even be about what's actually happening, but about what's happened in the past.
No question. Let me give you a quick story with that, and we're starting to run out of time. I was 8 years old. I'm standing in front of the mirror. I'm playing cowboys. I've got my hat on, my cap guns. I'm screaming. I'm yelling. My dad walked in, and he laughed at me, shut me right off. And as an 8-year-old, I played in front of the mirror again, but that was the last time I did it out loud. As an adult, I understand it. I've got a handle on it. I know what it was. But as a teenager, you didn't dare talk down to me. You didn't laugh at me. Unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience. I'm getting into an argument with somebody or a fight with somebody because of something that happened in the past had nothing to do with what's going on now. It was something familiar. It activated that marker, and now I'm going full-blown. And I think that in and of itself is a way people can begin to understand how they respond and react to things that happened in the past that they're not consciously aware of. And with that, we're starting to run out of time. Srini, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. The website I'd recommend is neurobusinessgroup.com. It's N-E-U-R-O, and then the word business, all one word, group.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Srini Pillai, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. Again, the book is Your Brain and Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders. Hey, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Try because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly.
Each night, we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Diets fail. They leave us hungry. They leave us lethargic. They leave us miserable. And after a cycle of yo-yoing, and often we end up even heavier than we were when we started. Mark McDonald says that. He's the author of Body Confidence, Venice Nutrition Three-Step System that unlocks your body's full potential. And let us say, Mark, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I think in today's world, if you walk through any supermarket, Mark, they should be grabbing what you have put to pen and what you've created here. I don't even understand how this advent of obesity has rocked this country. So let me start from scratch with you. Where was it that caught your eye about how to get rid of this problem?
You know, I've lived it. You know, when we look at the problem, why obesity is so rampant, is it comes back down to what we're being taught from the educational side. That sure. We're still focusing on calories in versus calories out. That we're set up on that you should cut your calories, you should burn more fuel than you're taking in, and then that's going to let you drop weight, but it doesn't allow you to actually reprogram your metabolism. And then once we start going back to what we were doing before, we put it all on plus some. You know, I was an athlete. Since I was 7 years old, ate whatever I wanted, used exercise to stay lean. When I finished playing soccer in college, kept eating poorly, stopped exercising, put on 60 pounds by just still eating poorly, and then I freaked out, and I did what a lot of us do. I went on a high-fat, high-protein, cut all my carbs out, cut my calories down, went back to exercising a lot, and in 4 months, dropped my 60 pounds, took my body to 4% body fat, and lived as a fitness model for 4 years, looking amazing and feeling horrible. So I think the long story short of it, Michael, is that, you know, we're all looking for a way to look and feel our very best. But wherever we turn, we're still inundated with we need to exercise more, we need to eat less, and that philosophy and that concept does not work, and that's why I created the program.
By the way, Mark, you said something very interesting, and I caught that. It was looking good, I'll use my words, looking good, but feeling horrible. There are so many people that are going through that right now. What's that bridge? What is that certain something that seems to be missing in most of the diet and nutrition programs that we're seeing today?
Well, everything's based along calories in versus calories out, meaning you have to cut and you have to restrict. And this is the question I ask. When is a deficit ever a good thing? It's not good to go out and spend $10,000 on a credit card. Eventually you have to pay that back. Same thing when you look at cutting calories. When people start diets, I call it your tipping point. Weight's heavier than it's been before, energy's low, pants are too tight, and you just want to do anything. Your frustration is so high. You're most vulnerable. So you do the diet of the month. You cut everything. You drop the weight. You sacrifice. You don't eat the food you enjoy. You drop the weight, and you feel good for a moment. And then life starts to push back a bit. And everything you abandon starts working back in. So you're looking good, but you're not feeling good. Your energy starts to falter a little bit more, and that's what causes that yo-yo syndrome that all of us are familiar with.
Now, by the way, you mentioned a very interesting word. When you mentioned the word metabolism. Let's lay a base. People hear this word constantly. That doesn't necessarily mean, Mark, that they know what the word means and the effect it has on your overall health.
Your metabolism is the energy you burn on a daily basis. And the answer is through stabilizing your blood sugar. So imagine this. Imagine eating every 3 to 4 hours the right amount of protein, fat, and carbohydrates per meal and the right amount of calories. That's going to keep your body in an internal hormonal balance, and it will allow your metabolism to burn the most amount of body fat and energy and produce the most amount of energy for your body to work. So we're all born genetically with a particular rate that our body's going to process energy. It's kind of like a car, where you have certain cars that can burn a lot more fuel than other cars. But the reality is that whatever your metabolism, whatever you feel you sit at in the sense of whether you feel like you can just look at food and gain weight, or you feel like you can eat anything and never gain weight, or you feel like you're somewhere in between, we can actually reprogram your metabolism, shift the mindset from cutting food to actually teaching you how to create internal hormonal balance through stabilizing your blood sugar, and then that sets your body up to reprogram your metabolism and achieve permanent results.
So when we're talking about body confidence, it's not my emotions, it's not my mindset, it's what my actual body does by itself. The body in and of itself has confidence within itself because you're feeding it the right nutrients, etc., to be able to function the way it's supposed to function, which in turn will affect the emotions.
Yeah, it's all body confidence to me is really looking and feeling your very best. You know, I think that's, you know, anyone can lose weight. So you can look good, but can you feel good? And then a lot of times people think they're feeling good, but can they feel better? So physically, you can never look and feel your best if you don't create internal hormonal balance, if you don't understand and shift the mindset from using deprivation or calorie restriction as your foundation or exercise as your foundation to really understanding to use nutrition as your foundation through stabilizing your blood sugar. Then that's going to give you the power to actually address the emotional stuff, you know, the attachments to food, you know, getting very clear on what your health is. And that's really why I created a three-step system to help people understand how to create a foundation where they can work from to really take their body to another level.
Okay, Mark, I want to go back to where I was because I was reading this and the thought struck me as I began to look deeper into this. There's two entities we're dealing with here, and stop me if I'm wrong because I'm not a clinician. I'm just listening very closely to what you have to say here. You've got Mark. You've got Mark McDonald, the person's the essence of that causes you to be and do who you are. Then the other entity is you got Mark, you got your body. Your body functions in a certain way. You feed it the right thing, your body works with you. You don't feed it the right thing, your body works against you, which affects you who Mark is. And I really believe body confidence is allowing the body to have its own confidence in itself to be able to fully function the way that it was set out to function, as opposed to us putting all the roadblocks and the challenges and all the things that we shouldn't be eating. So I'm really hearing, and again, stop me if I'm wrong, you got two entities to deal with, yourself, your emotions, and then the body in and of itself, because the body needs certain things. It needs that hormonal balance, that homeostasis to be able to truly function, because if the body's not feeling good, neither are you and I.
Michael, you're spot on, and I love how you laid that out. And that's the point, that so many times we're first addressing the emotional response without addressing the physiological response. And you're so right that if you can stabilize your blood sugar and actually create internal hormonal balance, then that empowers you to actually address the emotional response. Spot on.
Yeah, and I know so many people who have gone through the gastric bypasses, the stuff, they do it for a certain period of time. And Mark, within a year or 2 years, they've got the weight back. And I've heard some statistics there, people actually commit suicide. So there also has to be that balance. And you're right, I've seen people who look absolutely wonderful, but if you sit down with them, they don't feel so good. And I think it's the combination of the two. And even in the tagline, the three-step system that unlocks your body's full potential. It is potential, isn't it?
The body's the most amazing thing. And I think that when you talk about gastric bypass and why people put the weight back on after, it's because they don't understand. It's an education. As a society right now, the core root of it is no one's really ready to spend the time, well, many people are, but many people are not ready to spend the time becoming educated about their body. When we think of a baby feeds every 3 to 4 hours. They have breast milk, which is protein, fat, carbohydrates. They stop eating when they're satisfied. They eat again when they're hungry. From the first breath we take, that's how our body's meant to physiologically be fed, because it stabilizes our body hormonally, balances our blood sugar. And then that allows us to be in homeostasis. Come that second year of life, a baby has enough stored reserve so they can abandon that feeding process. You go to your doctor. I mean, my son, you know, first year of life, everything was about his feeding. Second year of life, you know, just do what your parents are doing. Does he fit the height-weight chart? But see, that's not how the body's meant to be fed, and you were spot on. You have two choices. Feed your body the way it's meant to be, and your body will be working for you, and you'll continue moving forward, or you don't, and your body has to step in. And whenever it steps in, there's a cost, and that cost is typically lower energy, burning muscle mass, and storing fat.
Now, by the way, when there's something where we've got about a couple, 3 minutes left, but one thing I want to bring up that I think is critically important when we think about losing weight, and this is within your press release, this hit me very strong here, that most people, when you talk about losing weight, you want to lose 40, 50, 60, 30 pounds. But I would say that the bulk of everybody that really wants to lose weight, where they get stuck, is those people who just want to lose 10 pounds. And that in and of itself is so tough for so many people.
It is, and it comes back down to utilizing nutrition, finding your nutrition rhythm and your exercise rhythm. So when I teach people and I educate people, it's not about doing more, it's about becoming better at what you do. So the first step is you must stabilize your blood sugar. Protein, fat, carbohydrates, and the right breakdowns, the right meal intervals, right calories. That's going to put your body in balance. That's going to force your body to release its stored fat. Then we optimize your exercise, and all of it's laid out in the book Body Confidence. And we optimize your exercise, and that fat you're releasing through stabilizing your blood sugar then gets burnt up in your muscle for energy, and that's how you lose the last 10 pounds. That's how you take your body to another level, and that's how you permanently reprogram your set point or your internal metabolism.
Now, by the way, I have the book in front of me, and there's a lot of before and after pictures on the back of the book, etc. And you can look at the look on the people's faces who dropped the weight. It's more than just losing the weight. It's almost a, I'm going to say, a return of or a creation of the first time they've ever had dignity in their entire life. You ask a lot of people who are overweight if they're happy. They may lie to you in front, but when you get underneath it, they're not happy. They didn't get the job they wanted because they were afraid to walk in and apply. They didn't get the boyfriend, the girlfriend they wanted because they were afraid to ask the question, and so on and so forth. And socially, they've been pushed aside for the most part. So it's not just losing weight. It's about the recreation or the creation of an entire lifestyle.
Exactly. The majority of people right now, we've set the bar so low that people reach to be average. See, I want us to reach to be the best that we can be, and I think people want that. When you go through the book and you see all the success stories and the thousands that have done our program, the reality is that they just were looking for a better way and they didn't know where to go. And that's the thing, if we can really get our education in place and you can really learn how to feed your body optimally, exercise efficiently, you will take your body to another level. And what you get from it is everything. It takes you to a place where we all want, and that's really when we talk about the body confidence. It gives you confidence in every aspect of your life.
You know, I love that on page, I memorized the book here, on page 10, Abby McDonald, there's a picture of the before and after with her. If you look at her face before, she looks like a very sweet woman, no question about it. But if you look at her face afterwards, there's not only sweetness, but there is an air of confidence in that face. There's the difference between the two. It moved into the different level.
Yeah, Abby's my wife, and that's the biggest thing when we look at what she went through. I mean, she was a core piece of how I created the sixth component, which we call the Body Confidence Plan. She had a physical injury, saw her body deteriorate over a year, and we realized that it was just much more than just stabilizing your blood sugar. It was that actually creating balance with your sleep, nutrition, exercise, base supplementation, water, and stress. All six components gave her balance back in her body and, in essence, gave us our lives back.
You just really said it, gave you your life back. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website, or, of course, there's the website we can find you at and buy the book, sign up for the programs, and do what we need to do?
Website is Venice, like Venice Beach, California. That's where we started, venicenutrition.com. You can read all about the program. We have practices nationwide. We have an online software program. And then, obviously, the book is Body Confidence.
Wonderful. Hey, Mark McDonald, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we... Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are free. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dwayne McCauley coming up next.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark. Dwayne McCauley with us is the author of Death to Diabetes, How an Ex-Diabetic Beat Diabetes Despite a Blood Glucose Level of Over 1,300. Local engineer on the brink of death, went into a diabetic coma at Rochester General Hospital with a blood sugar level of 1,337. That's more than 1,200 points above normal, and lived to tell about it. Dwayne McCauley was able to overcome severe hypoglycemia and also two blood clots, pneumonia, high cholesterol, four insulin shots a day. He used his engineering and his biochemistry background to repair his body and methodically and completely wean himself away off of the insulin and some of the other drugs that he was taking, and eventually to write the now acclaimed and top-selling book, Death to Diabetes. And let us say, Dwayne, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Dwayne, when we think about this with diabetes and the effect that it's having on the population, here you got a guy who ends up with 1,337 with a blood sugar level, 1,200 points above normal, and you beat it. Was it a mindset? What was it when you found out everything you had to face? What were the first things that went through your head?
Very good question. I run workshops around the country, and everyone asks the same question. And the answer? My mother.
Yeah,
my
okay.
mother, my daughter, they basically they got on the plane and came up to take care of me. And my mother threw all the food in the kitchen. She threw out my pizza pies, the soda, the ice cream, everything. And she replaced it with raw food, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, spinach, the three vegetables that I hate, Michael. And my mother said, son, this is what we grew up on, back home on the farm. And this is what you need to eat to get better.
And realistically, when you think
about it, I listened to my mother, and I got better. And the doctor's shocked.
Well, realistically, when you think about this, Dwayne, moms know, you know, they when you go back to it and you think about the food that we should be eating as opposed to the food that we do eat, there's billions of dollars of advertising pumped into causing us to eat the foods that are going to get us sick, which causes us to spend more money. And I think getting out of routine.
Yeah. And I watched all those commercials, Michael. I love the, McDonald's, the Kentucky Fried Chicken. But once I got out of the hospital and the doctors basically said, Dwayne, you'll be on insulin the rest of your life. You've got to take Coumadin, a blood thinner. You got to take Lipitor because your cholesterol's off the charts. You're facing a possible double amputation. You're going blind. There's not much more we can do but to tell you to keep taking the drugs. And being an engineer with a biochemical background, it didn't make sense to me that I should have taken all these drugs.
Yeah.
And those of your listeners that know anything about diabetes, one of the things that the doctors tell you is to measure your blood sugar at least 3 to 4 times a day. But I'm an engineer, so I decided to measure my blood sugar 8 times a day so I could collect more data. And once I started to collect the data, I started to see some anomalies. And I began to realize the insulin shots aren't really making me any better. So I started to wean myself off the insulin while my mother was stuffing me with the broccoli and the Brussels sprouts. Long story short, 3.5 months later, the doctor said, this is impossible. This is impossible. You cannot get off insulin in 3.5 months. And they took me through a battery of tests, and they said, your A1C is better than mine. Your blood sugar average is 87.5. Your A1C is 4.5%. That's impossible. And they And the nurse said, Duane, you've got to tell us what you did. So I told them. They wrote it down. And my daughter said, Dad, the doctors are writing down what you're saying. And that's when she said, Dad, I think you should write a book. But, you know, daughters, I thought, okay, yeah, right. No one's going to listen to an engineer. And then the American Diabetes Association called, and they said, we heard your story. Is it true your blood sugar was over 1,300 and you almost died? And I said, yes. So I went in and talked to the diabetic support group. Everyone in the group got excited. There were 12 people in the diabetic support group meeting. 3 months later, they invited me back. 300 people showed up.
Wow.
And I said, whoa. And that's when I knew, okay, there's more to this than what I thought. I thought, okay, I got lucky. And this happens every day. But I found out it doesn't happen every day. And the next thing I knew, I wrote a little pamphlet. It was 2 pages, How to Beat Diabetes. And eventually it led to writing the book, Death to Diabetes.
Okay, so when we're really dealing with, okay, it's not just death to diabetes. We're talking, Duane, we're talking about an entire lifestyle change. We're talking not only about diabetes, but when you get your body in working condition the way it's supposed to work, you're talking about eliminating heart problems. I mean, you know, this list could go on and on for hours. So in essence, it's death to diabetes and everything else that can cause a problem if you're not taking care of your body the way your body needs to be taken care of.
Exactly, exactly. Yep.
No, because when you really come down to it, now from this, I mean, obviously you move through something that you shouldn't have moved through. Where is it going from here? And when I say where is it going from here, you talk all over the country, but you've got to get even farther than that if you're going to really hit it, because the book in and of itself is wonderful, but it's got to go to those places that have control over A, the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and I mean, this list goes on also. So to get that message out is a very important thing. But here's the big question for you. Where do you find yourself challenged? Where are you blocked? Where do you find it?
Very, very good question. Very good question. Because once I got better and once the book sales took off, and then corporations would call me and ask to come in and do different talks and things like that. But no matter where I traveled, it was like, wow, everyone was shocked. Everyone was surprised. Which meant I'm not really impacting America. And so I tried to get on television, called Oprah. My daughter called Oprah. I called Oprah, called Larry King. They're retired. The pharmaceutical companies, because I've been to a couple of their conventions. They say, we don't like you. I said, why not? I'm helping America. They said, no, you're not. Because if America found out that an engineer came up with a medical protocol that would actually reverse their diabetes, we would lose money.
Big
and
money.
I said, what? And they said, yeah, we're not going to allow you on television. So it's been an uphill battle trying to get the message out to America. And now that the book is even doing better than when I first released it, because I'm now up to version 3, it's now gone international. But again, getting back to your point, Michael, the big challenge, and I never expected to really take this on as a mission, yeah, is to figure out, okay, there are 24 million diabetics in the United States. There's another 60 million who don't know they're diabetic. There are over 270 million diabetics worldwide. We live in the world of technology. I'm an engineer. How do I get to all of those people? Haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Okay, but you realize that the numbers of 270 million, that is almost the entire population of the United States.
Yep. And everybody, Michael, everybody knows someone who's diabetic. Or I should say, every one out of every 2 people knows someone who's diabetic. So this epidemic is bigger than just the 24 million people. Because there are a lot of people who are, I mean, they're struggling in this country. We struggle with health care. We struggle with our finances. We struggle with our health. And I do workshops for senior citizen groups. And they say, Mr. McCauley, we can't afford $24.95 for your book. And I say, you don't need my book. They said, what? I said, you don't need my book. Because the doctors who come to my workshops, they say, oh, you're just trying to sell a book. I said, no, you don't need my book. Go to the website, deathtodiabetes.com. The information of my program is on the website. Download it. It's free. because I want to get this information out to the entire world if I can figure out how to do it. And
Dwayne, one of the best ways to do it, and it's been that way for years, talk shows, and basically...
Well, you're right, Michael. My daughter, she goes, Dad, you need to call up those radio shows. You need to talk to these people. And she mentioned you. She mentioned a few others. And I said, okay, I'll try to find some time in my schedule to talk to the radio shows. Because radio shows seem to be more open. You seem to be more flexible in terms of listening to a controversial message that would get the TV stations in trouble.
Now, by the way, this wouldn't get the TV stations in trouble, the radio stations in trouble, but your message is very controversial. You stop somebody from making money, and you go to war with them, and we know that. But radio, and it's always been this way, Dwayne, radio is word of mouth. Somebody will tell somebody,
Okay.
And your message has got to be contagious. It's got to be viral. That's one of the ways to do it. The other suggestion I have, go on Twitter, go on Facebook, go on all of these social networking the organizations that they have out there, and just start flooding it. And now you're not talking to tens of thousands. You're talking to hundreds of millions because it goes globally. We get people.
See, my daughter would love you. My daughter would kiss you right now because she said this. She said, Dad, she was the first one. She was the one to put me on YouTube, and that's when it exploded. I didn't want to go on YouTube. And this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago when YouTube first started out.
Yeah.
And my daughter, put me on YouTube. And just a year ago, maybe even just 6 months ago, my daughter said, Dad, you've got to get on Facebook. You've got to become more visible. And she was right, because once I got on Facebook, I met an entirely different audience. So yes, Michael, you are right on the button. So I'm trying to use these other platforms like Facebook and YouTube, MySpace.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And just trying to just make people aware that they can get better. And there are some clear messages that diabetics need to hear. And one of those messages that they need to hear is that I meet diabetics all the time who are trying to get better, but they give up. And they give up because they're on the wrong diet. And they give up and they blame themselves. And it's not their fault from that standpoint. It turns out they're eating the wrong food. There is healthy food that's not healthy. Cereal in the morning will kill you. And once I take my clients off the cereal in the morning, they get better. When they stop eating oatmeal in the morning, they get better. When they stop eating wheat bread in the morning, they get better. And so you transition people to a plant-based type diet, and move them away from these foods. Milk is not good for you if you're diabetic. And you move them from these so-called healthy foods that are actually not healthy, and they see improvements almost immediately. And see, with diabetes, you have a blood glucose monitor. So most people can test my program, and within 14 days, some people say within 7, they know the program is going to work because all they got to do is measure their blood sugar. They can see that it's going to come down. Yes, you're right, Michael. You're exactly right.
Wait. You got one problem. It's too simple. You hear that?
That's what when I do workshops and people, I put up the protocol. They said, "Is that it?" I said, "That's it." When I was sick, Michael, the dietitians, the nutritionists, the doctors, they made it complex But see, engineers, we don't like complex. We like to take complex and make it simple. That's my job. And that's what I was taught for 30 years in corporate America. I didn't realize that what I learned in corporate America was actually going to help me design a protocol that would help people fight a disease.
No, and it got you loud and clear, because when it really comes down to it, it's those mistakes that we make. It's when we fall down. It's when we get sick. And then we come back, and we come back bigger and stronger. And why have people go through all the stuff when you can give them all your experience and they don't have to do it? They can anticipate it. They can know what's going to happen ahead of time. And if you can just through food alone, you can avoid the problems that you can get into. And I want to go back to where it was before. It's not just diabetes. It's heart problems. It's blood pressure. It's my goodness.
Well, it turns out that heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, osteoporosis, all of these degenerative diseases, they're basically similar pathologies. I now do workshops with doctors in the audience. They take notes when I talk. And I take them through the pathology at the cellular level and show them this is what the disease is doing to the body at the cellular level. Now, it turns out that the cells are damaged. They're inflamed. But guess what? It turns out that there are foods that contain the necessary nutrients that trigger the biochemical functions in the body that actually initiate the repair process. The doctors go, wow, that's right. And I said, okay, would you say that on YouTube? And they go, oh, no, Dwayne, we can't go public with this.
Dwayne, when it comes down to it, you see, that's where you've really hit it. You said the operative word is biochemicals. Everything eat turns to a chemical. That chemical that's produced is going to go to a certain part of the body that's going to make you feel good or make you not feel good. So based on what you eat is how your body's going to function. And the dynamic that occurs is basically affecting your immune system. Nothing cures anything. The immune system does it. Not a pill, not a medicine, not a whatever. And if you shore up that immune system and you give it what it needs to function, you live comfortable, you live happy.
Excellent, Michael. You just hit another home run, because a lot of people are surprised when I mention to them the reason why they suffer, the reason why they suffer with the diabetes, the heart disease, the osteoporosis, the arthritis, the reason why they suffer is because their immune system has been compromised. Their immune system can no longer fight the war. And so I teach them, here's how you fight the war. Here's how you acquire the weapons of mass destruction. And here's how you destroy the beast. Here's how you destroy the disease. And when you talk in those terms and you give people very simple tools and show them how to beat diabetes on the head, they love it. Because people, they want to get better.
Sure.
They want to live a better life, but no one is coming on television. No one's coming on the radio to tell people this is what you need to do. All over the internet, there are diabetes scams, people just trying to get their money. And I've read all this. I've done all the research. To counteract that, I said, look, people, I don't want you to give me your money. I just want you to go to the website. Try the program. It's free. I don't need your money. I'd like to have your money, but I'd rather you get well first. Because if you get well, you're going to tell somebody else.
No question.
And the marketing people, they don't like the idea, but I think it's one of the best ways to try to get the message out to people.
Dwayne, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Website we can find you at. What is the website?
The website is deathtodiabetes.com. They don't need to remember the name of the website. There's only two things people need to know, diabetes and engineer. I was an engineer for 30 years. I had diabetes. If you take the two words, diabetes and engineer, put them in Google, I come up on the first three pages of Google.
Wonderful.
Diabetes, engineer, that's all they got to remember if they don't remember death to diabetes.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have you back on. Great message. Go out and get them.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Michael. It was great. Great interview. Great questions. Love it.
And a lover's burning light will warm them in a night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return here, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back, Susan Marshall, President, Executive Advisor, LLC, the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And she's creator of the Backbone Institute. And welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael Ray.
Did you bring cookies?
No.
I'm disappointed.
I know. Yeah. I knew you would be. Boy, there's a lot of that going around, huh?
I know. Disappointment. Disappointment. I thought you were going to bring cookies, but I'll have to live with it.
Uh-huh.
I expected certain things,
well,
and it didn't happen.
Yeah, it didn't happen. Well,
no.
Why would you think I would bring cookies?
It was what I thought. It had nothing to do with what you were going to do. I'm disappointed because I thought you were going to bring cookies. You got nothing to do with it. Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating? You know, it's real interesting. We're going to be in Dallas again next week working with this charter school system, and one of the things we're going to spend a lot of time on is conflict. And, you know, if you're
go ahead, start with me.
You're not like everybody else, but a lot of people don't like to even talk about conflict. They don't want to deal with it. They don't want to address it. But if you think about it, nothing ever gets done without conflict.
You want conflict? Wait a minute. Let me give you conflict. Wait, look what I've got over here. I found a book the other day. I hope it didn't go away. All right, I found a, this is conflict now. 1964 through 1967, it was the Milk and Ice Cream Drivers and Dairy Employees Union, local yada yada. This was the Dairy and Ice Cream Agreement. Agreement, okay, you ready for this?
Uh-huh.
I swear to you, this is what's in it, okay? You want conflict? Wait till you hear this. Article 15, female. The employer shall not employ female help on any identical operation as now performed or herefore performed by male help.
Wow.
I got it right here.
That's fascinating. Wow. Well, there's an expectation, huh? Yeah.
I'm going to carry that with forever.
Conflict is part of life, as is disappointment. And so rather than thinking about it or treating it about it, you know, it's like, oh, geez, it's something I need to avoid. I have to avoid being disappointed. Or if I get disappointed, I have to kind of ignore it, right, and explain it away or just get rid of it entirely. When in fact, just like conflict, it brings us new ideas. It challenges us to do different things. Disappointment serves the same role. And you're right in that you expected cookies. I had no idea that you were thinking I was going to bring cookies. So you know what, pal? Your problem, not mine.
Yeah,
but
I'm disappointed.
Isn't that the way disappointment works?
Yeah, now if I go out to the door later on and find a box of cookies there's possible forgiveness in this.
I'd be very surprised if that happened.
Possible.
You have to let me know.
Remember,
yeah.
I've got the union agreement here. Go ahead.
Oh, that's right. Girls can't play. That's
right.
Funny. Well, we have made progress. So we've obviously confronted that bit of conflict and managed the disappointment of the people who wrote that particular thing, right?
Now, you know you can drive a truck and deliver ice cream now?
Well, I'm tickled to know that. Not something I'd ever do, but gosh,
Radio
I feel liberated.
Susie up here just fell off her chair after she threw something at me. Go ahead.
Yes.
Conflict.
Well, I, at risk of turning this into a political discussion this evening, I want to look at the case study that is absolutely in front of us now as the poster child of disappointment, and that's Barack Obama. And I don't want to approach this from a political standpoint, Democrat, Republican, Independent, I don't care, but he had such high, he had raised such incredibly high expectations.
Sure.
For the country, for individuals, for jobs, for, you know, unity, for all of the things that people in their hearts and souls really want, and has dashed almost everyone, maybe every one of them. And so when we think about that disappointment, it's a surprise. It's like, but gosh, I thought this was going to work. I thought this guy was going to be the next, you know, JFK in terms of being really a dashing, what's the word I want, motivating, inspiring president. And he has not succeeded. And so we're surprised by that. So the first thing that disappointment does is it really kind of jolts our awareness. It's like, well, wait a minute. And you know, the news, obviously, over the last week has not been good for the president. You know, joblessness is up. You know, jobs are down. The economy's down. All housing is down. Just so many things that we didn't expect. Now, just as you thought I was going to bring cookies, or you expected I was going to bring cookies, and I didn't, your expectation was unreasonable. I would say,
yes,
in the same way, our expectations collectively of one individual were wildly unrealistic.
Oh, Susan, there was one good thing that came out of all of his promises. I'm serious. Nancy Pelosi's income went up 62% last year.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
Did you see that? Yeah, that's
did.
A real...
I was astounded. It's like, how... Well, and this is another thing, you know, disappointment forces us to do is to figure stuff out. It's like, how is that possible?
She got up and said, just write the check. I'll tell you what it's for afterwards.
Yeah. Pass the bill. We'll tell you about it later. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. But so what I'm suggesting here is that disappointment is our friend.
Yes.
Because it wakes us up. It forces us to say, you know what, maybe what I expected, and it becomes more than hope, it becomes an expectation, maybe that was unrealistic. And some people get stuck there and say, well, okay, I guess I don't know what to expect and I don't know what to do and woe is me and I'm just going to sink into my pity pot and I'm going to let somebody else come and take care of me. And so, and a lot of people are there, frankly, right now. But disappointment, and particularly keen, deep disappointment, forces us to consider what it is we really want. And you're the master of this. What did people really want as they were listening to candidate Obama?
To be taken care of.
See, I disagree with that. I think the reason
people got so excited
was they wanted to be proud of themselves. They wanted jobs to come back. They wanted the nation to be strong again. They wanted to say, look at us. We are so wonderful. This is our first black president. He's wildly successful. I think they wanted to be proud of themselves. And yet...
Let's go into this. And there's no proving right or wrong. That doesn't even work anymore. But the point of tension is, I've listened to a lot of people. I've watched a lot of people. And if you want something to do something for you, you either give them something or you promise them something. In the end result, it was give me, give me, give me, give me. And the problem is if you said to me, Michael Ray, give me and I gave you, see, you would do it based on the reasons that you just said, because of pride in yourself, dignity, and all of those things that make you who you are. But if that's not where you come from, because everything that you can give somebody, once they get it, in the mindset, in the people that I'm talking about, is they want more. It's not enough.
Yes.
So if you give
me
this, then you have to give me that. So realistically,
that was absolutely the lever that the campaign used. No question about it.
Yeah.
But we can't forget the backdrop And that was the tremendous disappointment, here it is again, in the Bush administration.
Oh, sure.
And so, and we were not proud of ourselves. And we, you know, our country is not well-liked. All of that was the backdrop. Now, put an articulate candidate who promised. And, you know, you take all of those promises, and of course we knew in the beginning that they were nonsensical because he could not pay mortgages, buy gas, as some people were interpreting the things that he said. And so the expectations overall were unrealistic and wildly inflated. And so now we're at a point, and, you know, I think happily so, even though things are very, very difficult, I think we have come face to face with the sobering disappointment.
Let me give you what the sobering is. Let me give you what the sobering is. As you're talking, I'm thinking, and this is what's coming out. The difference between being proud of oneself and not being proud of oneself. If you give me a place to live, if you give me food, if you give me things and I'm dependent on you to give me, I have no pride in myself. If you set me up in a situation whereby I can be independent and create those things myself, then now I've got dignity, I've got pride in myself. And I think that in and of itself is the difference. The people who really want to do it for themselves, you know, give me the tools, let me go to work, let me do these things. There's
right.
the pride.
Give me the structure, give me the tools, and then give me the freedom. Gee, how American is that? Yes, you're right. And yet we're losing, have lost a lot of that as a nation. Now we can trace the roots back, you know, a very, very long time and look at all of the different, you know, social and economic factors that go into it. But the point is that we are at a moment now of disappointment. And I'm suggesting that that's a good thing. Because now we've got to say, what were we thinking? What really do we want? The challenge, of course, is to get people speaking in
take that right down to a relationship.
Yeah.
You meet somebody, you fall in love, and you set up the expectations, and you go through the entire system of what you're talking about, and then... You went on false promises. And when I say false promises, that person, he or she, may not have promised you anything. It's what you thought you were going to get out of the relationship. And then you get to the point of the disappointment stage. You fall down, you break up, and then you meet somebody else. Now, one of two things can happen. You can either learn from the mistake, go on, become full. Same thing with a nation. Same. There's no difference. Or you can start the whole process over again and keep the routine, the system of the disappointment going.
And most people are well-schooled in keeping the system of disappointment going because it hurts. And here's where we have to acknowledge the disappointment. I'm hurt. I'm angry. I'm surprised. Whatever words they are. People don't like to feel any of those things. And so, fine, we break up. La, 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 la. I'm going to find the next person and the patterns because we have our patterns. They kick in, and if we're not aware and we're not thinking about and we, in fact, have not learned, you know, the pattern will repeat until we get to the point where we say, well, the whole world hates me.
Yeah.
You know, the whole world must be screwed up because nothing's working for me. And yet, again, disappointment after disappointment, what's the common denominator in every one of those, you know, unfortunate things? Whoops, that would be me. I don't want to deal with that.
Well, go near the mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, and that's the whole key. The whole world doesn't hate me. I hate me. And I'm going to set me up to do everything I can possibly do to prove me right about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I hate me. Well, of course, nobody would ever admit that. And then we come back to, what is it you really want? I don't know. I don't think people really know.
Then you're not going to get it. If you don't know what you want, you're not going to get it.
Exactly. You'll get a whole bunch of other stuff, and you'll convince yourself that it's stuff that you want, but you will be disappointed because you won't really understand. Back to the, you know, what did we really want? I think, truly, people wanted to be proud of themselves in the context of an election. All right, so we're making it sort of macro here. But on a personal level, and the relationship example is a good one, you did something. If I'm in relationship with you and you've decided you're done what my first question to me, most people will do this, what did I do?
Yeah.
Well, what I did is I failed to understand your expectations, hopes, desires, whatever, for the relationship. At the same time, I was not clear of what my expectations were. And that sounds very calculated, and people don't like to have those conversations. And yet, if we could learn to do that, we could get past a lot of stuff that takes a lot of time. Right? We'll go out for 6 months or 2 years and say, this is not what I want. Well, you know, why didn't we clarify that up front? Oh, because that's not romantic. So
it goes even farther than that. You say, what did I do? The answer to what did I do was you were being you. And being you, you might have been so good that other person didn't like themselves and figure out the only way they can beat themselves up was to make you miserable so you'd walk or vice versa.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sick how that, and it happens all the time. It happens all the time. Yeah. So, yeah, what did I do? What's wrong with me? No. How about, I'm really surprised, angry, disappointed, hurt. What can I figure out from this? And sometimes, and in particular, excuse me, my voice is weird tonight. Sometimes in a relationship situation, that's impossible because the person who has, you know, dislocated from the relationship is highly unlikely to talk. And if they will talk, rarely to tell you what's really happening. And so that's the challenge. In disappointed relationships is that we really don't ever get the straight skinny. So we make up stories.
And we don't get it in the public either. In politics, we don't get it. And you know why we don't get it? Because somebody's afraid if I say the wrong thing, you're not going to vote for me.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a real conundrum. And I think the other aspect of this that really kind of fascinates me is we live in a world of, you know, problems. And so our orientation to things often is one of deficiency. What's wrong that we need to fix? And certainly when people are disappointed, that's where they start. You know, what's wrong and what can I fix? What would happen if we started looking at, instead of approaching life with a deficiency mindset, you know, what's wrong and how can I fix it, to a capacity mindset? What can we develop individually and collectively to create new opportunity? And that is a classic, oh, give me my rose-colored glasses. That sounds oh so sweet and so idealistic. And in a certain respect, it is. And yet, if we can tap the energy that is absolutely stuck, it's like, okay, we can't, we're discovering shale, right, shale gas now, and all of the debate about fracking, we should, we shouldn't, it's legal, it's not legal. People are the same way. We've got amazing pent-up stores of energy throughout this country. People who want to do stuff, people who would do stuff, businesses sitting on, you know, stockpiles of cash, disappointed at what's happening. Well, let's start looking at what might we do.
Let me add something to this just for a moment, okay? The very first interview we had tonight, what happened to have been a psychiatrist, a medical doctor, who was working with brain chemistry. And he said, what happens with most people is you focus on one or two things. If you focus on the loss, you're going to have a certain reaction. If you focus on the gain, you're going to have a certain reaction. So the process is really refocusing, recentering yourself, and recreating. And that's really what you're talking about here. What are
In
you,
a very
when I
purposeful
say that,
way, yes.
Yeah, rhetorically, you know, what are you focusing on? Go ahead.
Right. Well, no, that's exactly right. And then how do you, and I love all the brain research that's going on right now, particularly as it pertains to the Internet. We're destroying some of the dendrites that have long-term memory and long-term deep meaning for bits and bytes, right? We're creating new wiring in our brains. But back to, if you focus on the loss, which is inevitable in the beginning. It hurts. I don't like this. I'm so sad. What did I do? What could I, you know, what should I have done? What should we collectively have done? that's normal in the whole grieving process, right? So acknowledging that and giving yourself time to experience that, then it becomes a question of very deliberately asking, what do I need to learn next? What do I need to do next? What do I need to try next? So we need better in the political sense. Collectively, obviously, we need better knowledge of the candidates. We need a better understanding of the situations within which they're trying to make decisions, and that's tough. But we'd all be well served to get smarter. And then what's the history? Right? Yeah. What's the history of the situations, and then what's possible? So a very purposeful feeding ourselves with good information, positive information, things that pertain to the disappointment we just survived to help us go in a new direction. So again, back to the original premise. In that sense, disappointment's a good thing.
Sure.
We need it. We need it to learn, and we need it to start changing patterns that we have lived our whole lives, many of us, that have not served us well.
So is this, you're saying to me that I don't get the cookies?
I'm thinking you're not going to get, well, you might get cookies from someone, but you're not going to get cookies from Susan
from me.
So, and you know, think about that. Who can you talk to?
Hey, yeah, that's
Radio
right.
Susie, find some cookies.
Yeah, no cookies. Okay. I'm destroyed, but I'll try to get my way through this now.
Yeah, go make some popcorn. That's good.
Oh, no, good idea. Ah, you see, I've got it. I'm good. Now, but the whole point here really is this. It's called be mindful. Be aware of what you're doing. Just take time, take a breath, and become aware of what your end result is. Because if I want to be disappointed and that's my end result, that's what I'm going to do.
Yes, and you're absolutely correct in saying that this is the mindfulness of this. I believe very, very strongly that we are... We must individually and collectively start slowing down. Now, that's absolute heresy and counterculture in a world that celebrates speed and technology is helping all of us do more, faster, blah, blah. But we're losing the ability to understand what it is we want, how we might go about getting it. And so we're kind of flailing collectively just to do stuff.
Let me give you a prime example of that. And we're starting to run out of time, but a prime example of that is this. You've been on the air now, 20 minutes or so, and you've been concentrated on a particular thing. Where are you sitting by a desk?
Yes.
Touch the desk. The desk just came into existence when you touched it. Before you touched it, you were so concentrated on the show. I could say the same thing for me. It's not just you.
Yes,
sure. So concentrated on the show. The desk did not exist. Neither did the chair that you're sitting on. Neither did the dog that's probably laying down looking at you saying, feed me or something. That's the key. We get so concentrated, and what happens? Things don't exist. That's really what you're saying.
Right.
And on a level, and a much minor level, that's really it. Until you touch that desk, it wasn't there.
That's a very good illustration. And that, at the heart of it, and the speed with which we're moving, so much disappointment occurs because of what we're doing that we're not even aware of. You walked by me in the hall and you didn't say, hello, I'm really disappointed. Well, I was deep in thought about, again, your expectation that I would say hello when I was just doing what I do, and you're disappointed.
Still
every day.
Thought you'd been cookies.
What kind of cookies? What kind of cookies would have been there?
Yeah, I am not telling you chocolate now. There's no way you're going to hear that from me.
Okay.
All right, we got to go. Okay, website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Wonderful. Susan Marshall, we will see you next week. I'll be the one without the cookies. You'll recognize
without the cookies. Try not to have a disappointing week.
I'm disappointed I haven't started yet. Okay, good night.
All right, bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. Then
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Incredible places to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking. What is it? What am I saying here? Thought-Provoking Talk. I like live shows. Nina Amir with us. She is your inspiration to creation coach, and she's one of my favorite people. She inspires people. She really does to create the results that they desire, that you desire. When working with writers, she inspires them to create publishable, published products and careers as writers and authors. And there's so many writers and authors out there today. She inspires non-writers to create fully lived lives, their cherished dreams, their desires, their goals, and meaningful and spiritful rituals and practices. And in all cases, she challenges those she meets to find and fulfill their true purpose and potential in life. And Nina, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael Ray. It's great to be back.
Oh, we've missed you. I'm glad you're back on. I want to talk about something tonight that is critical. You know, there's so many authors today. I think the last number I got was something like a million plus new, brand new novels coming out every year. And they need a lot of exposure out there. And one of the ways that they get exposed is something called the blog. And most people, they hear the word, but practically, Nina, they really don't know what a blog is. So let's start from scratch. Let's create a definition, a base, and say, what is a blog and why is it important to a writer?
Yeah, you know, a blog comes from weblog and used to be thought of as this stream of consciousness. People would get on the internet and they would have this weblog and they would just write whatever they wanted, but it really is nothing like that anymore. It's really a focused focused way of writing about something that's really important to you. And for authors, I mean, for business people, it could be anything related to their business that's helping drive business, but authors, as far as I'm concerned, need to be business people. They need to wear a business hat a lot of the time, and for them, their blog is their business hub. It's their way to promote their book and their writing. And by having a blog online, it can be a website. A blog can actually be a website, but you know, all in and of itself. But it's a place where you write very short posts on a regular basis about the topic of your book. So a nonfiction writer might write short posts, say 250 words or 300 words on a regular basis, maybe twice a week, three times a week. It's great if they do it five times a week. And they write about something related to their book so that they're drawing interest in their book. They're getting fans that might want to buy their book. And a novelist would do the same. They're going to write about things that are related to their novel, so they're creating fans or people who are interested in the subject of their novel. So these, and in general, the idea is to create a readership for their book. And okay, that would be what a blog would be for an author or an aspiring author. There are millions of blogs out there on as many topics as you can imagine, Michael Ray.
No, I think it's absolutely wonderful. Okay, you are, and I know this, but I want to make sure the audience knows because it's going to lead me to my next question. You're a seasoned journalist, you're an editor, you're a blogger, you're writing, and you're an author coach. And most importantly, you're an inspirational speaker, a Kabbalistic consciousness, conscious creator coach. Now, when we talk about that, spirituality, and in spirituality in and of itself, it doesn't have to be Jewish, it doesn't have to be Christian, it doesn't have to be Buddhist, it doesn't. Spirituality is spirituality. And that inspiration that people get comes from wherever that is, and it transcends realistically all religions. When you're dealing with inspiration for somebody to touch that inside of themselves, where do you take that first step? Because I know you've got the new book coming out, 10 Days and 10 Ways to Return to Your Best Step. But it has to do with that inner self that most people don't know how to touch it, to reach it, to put their hands and arms and body and mind around it.
Right. So what they're coming from is their passion. What they're really looking for is their passion. What are they passionate about? And, you know, if you go back to the blog or to any book they want to write or anything they want to do in their lives, they're looking for what they're passionate about. I have a lot of people who come to me to work with me, whether it's, you know, in the Kabbalistic conscious creation coaching or whether it's book coaching or blog coaching. The clients come to me, and they may have something they feel really passionate about. I had somebody who came to me this week. She was passionate about the fact that she struggled through a divorce, of all things. You know, she had a divorce. She lost herself through that divorce, and the events around that created a scenario for her that gave her an epiphany about some things, and she wanted to share that, and that created a passion in her that she's creating a whole business around. Well, that's her passion. It's become her purpose. When you take that thing that you're passionate about and you combine it with a purpose, call it a mission. I mean, to me, it's a soul purpose, but if you don't want to be that spiritual about it, call it your mission, something you feel you have a mission to do in this world. You combine those two things, that leads you to feeling inspired. You're inspired to take action. When you have those three things, a passion combined with purpose, and inspiration, inspired action, that's when things happen. That's when you create something, because you just can't help it. You have to move forward. And when you are inspired, when you are in spirit, that's when the real you is showing through. That's when people see who you really are. You can't help but succeed when that happens.
You know, I think what happens with so many people, you feel like you have a purpose, you in the general sense of the word, and the purpose is wonderful, but it's stagnant without, quote unquote, the mission. The mission is going to encompass the action to get you there. So in essence, what you're really dealing with is you become a bridge from the purpose to the mission, if you want to say it that way, because that's where most people get stuck. They've got the idea, they've got the purpose, they've got the desire, and they've got the goal, but they don't have, well, not the goal, but they don't have the mission. And within the mission itself is the action to get there, the footpath.
Right, and sometimes they have a hard time finding that mission, that purpose. They feel passionate about something, but they're not sure how to get to the next stage. And what that's really about is giving. How are you going to give to the world? How are you going to make change in the world? Or how are you going to impact people's lives? What is it you want to do that's not about just receiving for yourself, not about just creating money or doing what you need to survive? And it's when you can see that bigger picture, when you can actually take that passion and see how it could benefit other people. And that's really what makes a great book. A lot of my clients who come to me, we have to go through a process of really evaluating their book, which is the other book that I've just come out with, is How to Evaluate Your Book for Success. And part of that has to do with looking at your book through the lens of a book proposal. I call it the book proposal process. And my clients come to me and we look. I just had somebody, we did this just the other day, and we had to look at what the benefits were of her book. What are the benefits to the reader? What are they going to get out of it? And it's the same for anything that we do. If we feel passionate about something and we feel inspired to do something about it, but we don't know what our purpose is, what's the benefit to the person, to someone else? If we do this, what benefit will someone else get out of it? And that's what makes anything a success, when we're giving, when we're benefiting someone else.
The most important thing you've said a lot of important things, but the most important thing you've said, I like the evaluating your book for success. It's that step-by-step workbook, and you can conceive a successful book before you even write it. What's important about that is this. If you don't know what your core message is, if you don't know what it is that's going to give you that value proposition, why you're different, if you don't know, your audience won't know either.
Well, that's right. and you have to find that out before. And that's my that's exactly it. And I had somebody come to me just the other day, and she wasn't sure. She had this. It was the same person with this idea about her divorce, and she knew that she had this great story, but she wasn't really sure how somebody was going to benefit by her telling that story. It was a memoir. And, you know, there are a lot of memoirs out there, and anyone can tell the story of their life experience, whatever it is. And I encourage people to do that because we all have stories that are worth telling and that people can benefit from. But it is that basic understanding of how somebody can get a takeaway from it. What is it at that really foundational level that somebody will needs to hear and will walk away saying, that story was told just for me? And you need to figure that out before you take the first step. And whether it's a book or a business, you need to know that.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with this, and you're right, before you take that first step, there's millions of, as mentioned it early on in the show, there's millions of brand new authors coming on the scene every year. And all the millions, and you mentioned the millions of blogs and so on and so forth, where do you go? Who holds you by the hand to take you to the place to say, this is a great potential for your blog to be seen? With all of that competition going on out there, Nina, it's got to be scary for people.
Sure, it's scary. Sure, it's scary. And that's why there are book coaches. And there are people like me who do hold a hand. But that's the number one fear I think that most authors have. I think that's what stops people from writing their books.
Yeah.
When I speak, I ask that question. You know, how many of you are afraid that you will write the book and that nobody will read it? And everyone raises their hand. Because
sure.
No one will read it. What that translates to is no one will buy it.
Yeah.
That's success. And the average book today doesn't sell more than 250 or 300 copies in a year, 3,000 in its lifetime. That's not a lot. So, you know, everyone wants to be a success. Everyone wants to be read. The reason people write is to be read.
Yeah, and by the way, that's what it comes down to, and that's something that I would venture to guess that anybody who's ever authored or thinks they're going to author a book, that's a very familiar scenario that's gone through their mind. And the key is to address the skepticism before it addresses you. That's why people like yourself are out there. That's why we've got people out in this world that will hold our hands to take us through those areas that we're not familiar with. We don't have the skills in yet. Because everything that we do, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of intuitive work that goes on. But most of it is learned skill. You don't just do something. There's a process to get you there till it becomes part of what you do. It becomes part of your, you know, your war chest. And then from that point, you move forward. But everybody's not just born with the idea of how to blog, how to write a book, how to be on the radio, how to do this. It's learned. And if you have the desire, you learn it. But once you've learned it, you've got it.
Sure you do. And you do have to seek out the information. You have to seek it out. And if you just step into it and you don't get the information, you'll have a failed blog and you'll have a failed book and you'll have done all that work for nothing.
No question.
Why I went to the trouble of writing How to Evaluate Your Book for Success. It is a step-by-step workbook for conceiving a successful book before you give birth to it. Why? Because you don't want to go to all that trouble and write the book or start the blog. My blog, How to Blog a Book, goes through the same process as in this workbook. It tells you to evaluate your blog before you begin it because you don't want to go to the trouble before, you know, and get it all out there and then discover that you have too much competition. You've written the same book that somebody else wrote. You know, you want to make sure that you've done your homework, that you haven't been a lazy writer, that you have done the homework and that you know who your competition is, that, you know, all of that, that you know what the market is, that you know that you've written a unique book, that you know that you've offered the benefits and features that your market is looking for. And so you either need to find a book that's going to help you or you need to find a coach that's going to help you, or you'll be like this man who came to me. He had written a book, and he'd even gotten a traditional contract. He'd gotten a traditional publishing contract. He had had a publicist. He'd been on the radio, all kinds of things, but his book wasn't selling. He hadn't done a whole bunch of the steps he needed to do. He hadn't figured out how to promote his book. His book happened to be unique, but he hadn't done some of the steps. He hadn't been a good business person, and, you know, that's really necessary.
Oh, no question. Nina, we're starting to run out of time. If I want my hand held, how do I find you?
You can find me either at www.ninaamir, that's N-I-N-A-A-M-I-R.com, or you can find me at www.copyrightcommunications.com, and it's spelled like playwright, C-O-P-Y-W-R-I-G-H-T, communications.com.
Nina Amir, we'll see you next week, and we will have some fun. Take care. Thanks
for
being here.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Good night.
Exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. George Lepree with us. He is the author of Fragging, Why U.S. Soldiers Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam. And after several years in the U.S. Army, George is currently pursuing a graduate degree at the New York School for Social Research. His first book, Himmler's Bosnian Division, was the recipient of the Sidney Zebel History Award from Rutgers University. And let us say, George, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we're dealing with fragging, let's define what that word means.
Well, the term fragging refers to a phenomenon that occurred during the later years of the Vietnam War. And what happened was U.S. troops, usually soldiers or Marines, they employed fragmentation grenades and other explosive devices to either kill or to maim or intimidate other Americans, usually their superiors, or South Vietnamese nationals. In other words, the soldiers were using grenades to kill their own officers rather than the enemy. The exact origin of this term in this context isn't really known, but it was in use by about 1969.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when you look at this, when we talk about Vietnam, et cetera, U.S. soldiers assaulting their officers, was this something that was going on continuously? Underneath, what's the message here?
Well, during the early years of the American involvement in Vietnam, morale and discipline among the troops was excellent. During the early 1960s and the advisory period, during the initial buildup, there weren't any real discipline problems. The court-martial rate was like 2.03 per 1,000 men. I mean, I don't think the Prussian army was that well-behaved. It really got its start in 1968. I think it was the Tet Offensive and that, and together with a few weeks after that, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., that really had a big influence on American forces over there.
Sure. Now, yeah, but one of the things, this is right from your press release, which I think is critically important to focus in on. As the Vietnam War dragged on, low morale, the erosion of discipline, illegal drug use, racial militancy that led towards trouble in the ranks, with the most chilling of acts, soldiers turning their weapons on their superiors. From everything that you've studied, George, and you've looked at, what caused this turnaround? What was the impetus behind this?
Well, I think there were several factors. First, when the president got on television on the 31st of March, 68, and announced that there'd be negotiations to end the fighting, what that told the troops was that, you know, this war was not going to end in a victory. We weren't going to, you know, push on to Hanoi or anything. We weren't going to fight it out until we defeated the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army in the field. It would end through negotiation. So the troops began to see, you know, little reason to exert themselves and risk their lives anymore. You know, that famous thing has almost become a cliche. No one wanted to be the last man to die in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And then also the length of the war was a factor. We were over there for 65, 66, 67. And what happened was the ranks of non-commissioned officers and junior officers thinned. The military became unpopular for young people back then. A lot of people didn't want to stay in. A lot of people didn't want to join in the first place. So they had to use accelerated promotions to, you know, keep leaders in the ranks. And what this served to do was you had social factors like racial tension, drug use. In previous years, they didn't find their way into the armed forces. But with this lower standard of leadership, they managed to get in, and they wreaked havoc among the troops.
Now, when we take a look at this, what was it for you that first caused you to sit back and take a look at it and say, I want to research it, I want to put it to pen? Where was it? What was in this for you?
Well, I had read many books about Vietnam, and when I entered the military, it was after the Vietnam era, but still a lot of the Vietnam guys were still there. They were mostly my bosses. They were the, you know, the senior NCOs and the field grade officers on up. And, you know, I'd heard about the word and, you know, what it meant. Some of the early books that came out about the war in the 70s and 80s, they'd mention fragging, but they never made any really authoritative effort at really examining it and deconstructing it. Some of the books would say that these things were, the fraggings were common occurrences. Others wouldn't say anything at all. When I select historical topics, I tend to, you know, I look at things that pique my interest. And if I'm unable to find enough sources about it, you know, to satisfy my curiosity, it's off to the archives I go.
You say, but what I think is interesting is I've been around the media for many, many years now. I was in the service. I was too young for Korea, but by the time Nam came around, I was already in and out already. I'm a former Marine. But I'd never heard of fragging, and I think that in and of itself is critical that you get this information out, because if the morale turns in the military, it turns on itself and it bites itself and it steps on its own foot. So I think the subject matter that should be out and explored, because I really believe a lot of people haven't heard this yet.
Well, when it first started, it's interesting. Fragging first started in late 1968 to occur in large numbers. And it wasn't until about 1971 that the press began to report on it. And by that time, we were pulling out of Vietnam, so perhaps that, you know, precluded people from hearing much about it. And like I said, you know, the early books about the war that appeared during the 70s and 80s, they don't say much. So as more and more records become declassified and available to researchers, I think studies like this will begin to appear in larger numbers.
Yeah. Now, by the way, if this were to happen today, how would this affect us? And the message would be, who should be responsible for this? Because it's not just a one or two persons that's responsible. It's an entire movement. If this happened today, what would this tell us?
Well, In the present conflicts in which the nation is involved, there have been a handful of these type of incidents. There was one that got a lot of press shortly before Operation Iraqi Freedom kicked off. That occurred at Camp Pennsylvania in 2003. Two officers were killed. I believe the perpetrator of that incident is on federal death row right now. Then there was another incident in which one Marine NCO attempted to kill another one with an explosive device. And a third incident that occurred in the 42nd Infantry Division, again, two officers killed. That fellow was acquitted in that case. So they're occurring, but in very small numbers. And I think the reason is, you know, there are some parallels between the Vietnam era and today. For example, I think in both cases, we're looking to withdraw U.S. forces while maintaining fledgling pro-American governments. In South Vietnam, it was Vietnamization. Today, we're trying to find ways out of Iraq and Afghanistan while maintaining the governments there that are pro-American. Also, there are organizational similarities. You know, we've been in Afghanistan, Iraq a long time, and, you know, when junior officers, NCOs are made to perform repeated tours of duty, second tours in Iraq, third tours in Iraq, some even fourth, it places strain on the armed forces. And it's that's when societal problems tend to find their way into the ranks. That's what happened with Vietnam. There are some key differences, however. You know, of course, there's no draft today. You know, the men who are over there are volunteers. And also, I think one smart move that the military is making right now is using a lot of National Guard and Reserve units over there. I mean, I remember when I was in the regular Army, you know, the regulars tended to look down on the weekend warriors. But in truth, the Reserves and National Guardsmen are older. They're more mature. They have jobs back home and families. And so for that reason, they tend to have fewer disciplinary issues than, you know, younger volunteers who are mostly teenagers.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, and I really believe if we take a look at what's going on, the amount of, not as much through Vietnam and Second World War, etc., but the amount of people coming back with psychological, emotional problems, and so on and so forth, they're mounting. There's a lot of kids killing themselves out there, and there's a lot of things going on that were always going on, but not to the degree that we're seeing it today. So something's got to change somewhere. And one of the things I believe that has to change, no matter what goes on during a combat situation, is the attitude is when these kids come home. Even hear a story of a soldier, a sailor, Marine, whatever the case may be, that lost their home because they couldn't make a payment while they were gone, or are homeless or need hospitalization or et cetera, there's a major problem. And one of the things that would keep morale up is to know that somebody cared about you. But if you're going to go out and risk your life and you're going to come back and face this, there's a whole other story which ties right to some of the things that happen, quote unquote, in fragging.
There are, when it comes to Vietnam, it's a little different than today. Today, at least among USO and among, I think, the populace in general, the general opinion of the military is higher than it was during the Vietnam era. A lot of times when you talk to people who served over there, and I interviewed quite a few for the book, they talk about the negative or just lack of any reception they received when they returned home after serving their tours. That might have been a factor. And like I said before, is the fact that they were fighting and they knew that the armed forces were being withdrawn from Vietnam. The war was ending without a decisive result. And, yes, that was indeed a factor.
Okay. Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, I picked this book up. And, I have it. It's a wonderful book. I read it page by page, cover to cover. George, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I read the book?
Well, there was one thing that I found during my research about these incidents. And in the early texts that appeared regarding Vietnam in general and fragging in particular, they would say that most of these incidents involved draftees, or they intimated that the perpetrators of these incidents were draftees, conscripts, guys who were, you know, didn't want to be over there, and that some overzealous or incompetent officer or NCO was forcing these men to risk their lives when they didn't have to, in effect. In other words, they were saying that these incidents occurred in infantry units that engaged in combat against the enemy. However, when I looked at the serious incident reports and other documentary sources regarding these cases, I found that a lot of these, most of them even, most of these fraggings occurred in combat support and service support units. There was a couple of incidents when cooks were using grenades against superiors who had made them angry. There was a fragging in a postal unit. That kind of took me by surprise. Now, a lot of these incidents occurred in the rear areas, and I believe the reason for that was that even though they didn't have to face the rigors of combat, you know, the men were still in Vietnam. They're away from home. It was still hot, and they had to endure what was basically a garrison-type situation with all the spit and polish, but without the amenities of, you know, life in the United States. You know, you couldn't leave the base and go anywhere, really. Most of South Vietnam and the villages were off-limits to the troops. So basically, it was just, you know, the troops got bored. They had to perform these duties in a war that seemed unrewarding. And then when some leader came along who, you know, seemed to be overzealous in his duties, that's when trouble began.
We're just about, George, we're about out of time. I want to thank you really for coming here. Let me ask you this last question. Website we can find you at and get the book.
It's www.fragginginvietnam.com. And there are a couple. I put some of the cases on there. Some of the actual reports, the courts martial and whatnot, and those resources are available.
Dynamite. Hey, George, thank you so much for your time and all the effort that you've put into this.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
The music softly dies.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
You're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out.